This episode is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. Whether you love true crime or comedy, celebrity interviews or news, you call the shots on what's in your podcast queue. And guess what? Now you can call them on your auto insurance too with the Name Your Price tool from Progressive. It works just the way it sounds. You tell Progressive how much you want to pay for car insurance, and they'll show you coverage options that fit your budget. Get your quote today at Progressive.com to join the over 28 million drivers who trust Progressive. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Price and coverage match limited by state law.
WNYC Studios is supported by W.W. Norton & Company, publishers of The Road to Freedom, Economics and the Good Society, by Nobel Prize-winning economist Joseph E. Stiglitz. The Road to Freedom, essential reading for those committed to the American ideal of an economic and political system that delivers well-being, opportunity, and meaningful freedoms for all. The Road to Freedom, available now wherever books are sold.
Listener supported, WNYC Studios.
This is the New Yorker Radio Hour, a co-production of WNYC Studios and the New Yorker.
You're here with Lenny Schiller. We're in what I affectionately call Lenny's Garage. I guess I'm known as a car collector. Some people call me Brooklyn's Jay Leno because I'm up to 63 cars, I believe. I've actually lost count. It's either 63 or 64.
I'm David Remnick, and thanks for joining us for the New Yorker Radio Hour today. I hope you're having a great holiday. We're starting the show off in a garage. A garage full of cars, vintage and antique cars going back to the 30s. They don't get driven very often, but you've seen some of them because for decades, Lenny Schiller has been renting these cars out to movie sets. Most recently, he had a car in the Spielberg thriller, Bridge of Spies. Here's Schiller with the New Yorker's Jonathan Blitzer.
Describe this car a little bit for us.
Yeah, it's a 1949 Chrysler Woody Wagon.
I thought the Woody Wagon was in Quiz Show.
Yes, you're correct. The Woody Wagon was in Quiz Show. It was used in the scenes upstate. I think it was shot at Sterling Forest. And actually, Robert Redford was in that car.
Wow, look at this car.
Because you could be anywhere. As long as it's there's nothing, anachronisms? Something that's later. Yeah, you could be almost anywhere. You pop a 49 car there, and it transforms the setting to the year of the car.
Dick, I'm glad you could make it.
Hi.
My original idea for collecting was to have one car from each year from 1936 to 1958. And there's a reason for that. Is over there is a 1936 Chevrolet. That was my grandmother's car.
That's so that was your first
that's
one.
That's car number one. That's car number one. As a little kid, when we visited my grandparents up in the Catskills, I would run into the garage. I guess I had the bug in me. I would run to the garage. It was actually a barn. And I would sit behind the wheel and, you know, make believe like little kids do.
Yeah.
But when my grandmother gave up driving and was going to part with the car, I really felt it was important to keep it in the family.
One time, you were driving in a movie, and your daughter was hiding in the back seat because she wanted to go on this ride with you.
Oh, yes. That was actually the first movie. That was the 36 Chevy. Yeah, that was the movie, The Chosen. I hadn't really worked on any movies, and she was a little kid and wanted to be in the car. And as we drove by, she popped up to look out the window, and they went, that of course ruined the scene, and it pretty much yanked her out of the car.
Anyway, now I can look like Errol Flynn.
Who is he?
Robin Hood. Captain Blood. Errol Flynn. You don't know who Errol Flynn is? The movie star?
Oh. Never been to a movie.
In Enemies, the Love Story, at first they used it as a prop, and then they also used it on another scene. When they were doing that movie, there was a video store on the corner, Hester Video, and he refused to let them cover up the sign. It's a post-World War II movie. So they paid me nice money just to park in front of that store and block the sign.
I mean, you've appeared in all of these films, sometimes as the soda man when you're driving your soda truck, sometimes
correct,
as a chauffeur.
The idea is to blend in with the scene. You don't want to call attention to yourself. And actually, most movies, like a car like this Volvo, which I just bought, this 63 Volvo.
Right, this red one.
They don't want a car like that in a movie. They prefer no yellow cars, no red cars, and no white cars.
Nothing to take the attention away from the scene.
Exactly
itself.
Correct.
Tell us about some other movies.
Well, I guess I had that Seltzer truck, and it was in a Paul Mazursky film, Enemies, a Love Story, with the late Ron Silver. And that was fun. I did get to play the seltzer man in that movie, carrying the seltzer bottles. And actually, I think the bottles are now worth more than the truck.
So that soda truck has been in several more films, too. I mean, that's maybe...
Yeah, I think it's at this point, it's been in 8 movies. The last big movie I worked on with that truck was Pollock in 1999.
The Ed Harris.
The Ed Harris, correct. The Ed Harris movie.
What's the matter, Jackson? You all right?
You've always been interested in rare pieces. I mean, you've not gone for the kind of flashy luxury cars, although you have some.
Well, my philosophy is, why have a Model A Ford when you can have a 1929 Durant or a 1924 Star that nobody has seen? Something really odd.
Was it the funeral where you taught some of these actors how to even drive
stick shift?
Oh, the funeral,
yeah. That was Chris Penn. Couldn't drive a stick shift. So I had to teach him how to drive a stick shift, at least pull the car up in first. He was kind of a character to deal with. And Christopher Walken. Christopher Walken could get into any car and drive it, you know, hands down.
Maybe one day they're going to find me with my blood draining into the sewer. And when I'm dead, I'm going to roast in hell. I believe that.
I guess my fondest recollections are some of the music videos. I actually provided the car for Parents Just Don't Understand, which is Will Smith's first video. It was a red Porsche, if you remember that video. But the most famous guy here is the Love Shack car, the 65 Chrysler 300, the one that's the color of pistachio ice cream. That was the actual car in the Love Shack video where I'm driving a Chrysler that's as big as a whale.
I got me a car, it's as big as a whale, and we're heading on down to the Love Shack. I got me a Chrysler, it's
that was kind of a revival hit for the B-52s. If I drive this car, it sometimes gets recognition.
Now and again, as a favor maybe to an old friend or because a project seems especially interesting, you'll do it. You'll do a film or a shoot. But for the most part now, you're here in the garage working on the cars that you love.
You know, I don't really mind taking the vehicle out for photo shoots. Mm. I really stay away from music videos because they're long hours. And movie work I'd only do if it's a favor.
Because I remember I was with you during the shooting of Bridge of Spies.
Yes, you're the big tall fella they kicked off the set, as I recall.
Well, I was protecting the bottles. I was watching the bottles,
that's right. But what they noticed, you had a small pad and you were taking notes. And
I don't know what gave me away.
Jonathan Blitzer, a writer and fact checker with car collector Lenny Schiller. This is the New Yorker Radio Hour. Now we're going to do something a little unusual. We're going to bring you a story that comes in 3 parts. The story's about a family, although maybe not in the usual sense. It's about an artist named Adriana Alti, the family she grew up with, the birth mother she met later, and the biological father she never met. Adriana is a childhood friend of the historian and New Yorker writer Jill Lepore, and together they'll tell the story of the search for the man known as Big Brown.
My name is Adriana Alti, and when I was 8 years old, the thing that I wanted most of all for my 8th birthday was a tape recorder. And this was because I was given to putting on little shows or making up little songs and that type of thing. So I get the tape recorder, and I was horrified. Do I sound like a black person? And I said, you know, to my mother, well, that sounds like a black person. She said, well, what do you mean? Like, people have voices and voices are the same. People are the same. And I was like, okay, that is not, you're just not going to get, you know, good information. Maybe they don't want to hurt your feelings. They don't know. You better need to find these things out on your own because people are not going to tell you the truth.
My name's Jill Lepore, and I write for The New Yorker, and I teach history at Harvard. I'm a historian, and I want to tell a story about origins. And this is the story of the origins of my friendship with my friend Adriana Alti, and it's also a story about race, and it's a story about sound.
The town I grew up in was a very small town in New England, and it was very white. It was white, white, white. And to tell you how white it is, there is a statue of a lamb, a white lamb, in the town common, and that is because Mary Sawyer of Mary Had a Little Lamb is from that town.
Mary Had a Little Lamb whose fleece was white as snow.
You know, there weren't really any people like me there. You know, first day of kindergarten, got off the bus, and you went, you know, marched up, and they asked your name, and then you either were in that class or the other class. And I told them, you know, my name. I later was to find out that, you know, they called my mother and said, you know, Mrs. Alti, did you send the foster child that you have to school today? And, you know, and she said, yes. And that's how I learned that that wasn't, you know, that was not my last name. Because they had my last name and what it really was on the list, which I didn't know. And I went home and they told me, well, actually, this is your actual name, but don't worry because it's going to change when you, you know, get adopted. And I was like, it was the first I'd heard of it. That was in September, and then I was adopted in December.
When she was five and went to kindergarten, there was a photograph of her in the newspaper because there's this picture of, so this would have been 1971, a bunch of little white kids getting on a bus, and then this little black girl who's like more than a foot taller than everybody else. And it was kind of like a Ruby Bridges photograph or something. That was really hard, and it was absent being part of a black family that was part of a political movement that was integrating schools. This was this tiny little girl carrying on her shoulders a history of racial segregation.
My family, they're great. They're very kind people. They loved me very much. And they just thought, well, we'll just love this child, and that's all. That's all I need to do. They didn't want me to feel bad, so they would tell me things like, you're just the same. You're just the same as everyone else. I know what they meant by that, and, I, you know, as in hindsight, I'm like, well, okay, I understand what they're trying to say, but I'm like, but I am different, though, and they're like, no, you're not. And I said, but I look different, and they're like, well, you're just the same, and it doesn't matter if you're, what color you are, you could be orange, you could be blue, you could be, and I'm like, well, I'm not orange or blue, I'm, you know, I'm this other color. And I remember being in a play, and I was like a snowman in the play. This boy said something like, you can't be a snowman, because snow is not brown. And I said, snow can be brown. Haven't you seen it when it's like dirty or, you know, like this and that? I really just thought, well, he's just stupid. How does he not know that snow can be, I didn't know he was insulting me.
I'm gonna float like a butterfly and sting like a bee. George can't hit what his hands can't see. Now you see me, now you don't. He think he will, but I know he won't. They tell me George.
The first person I saw who was the same color as I was that I thought looked really nice, like looked I liked the looks of, was Muhammad Ali. You know, he's so handsome and so, like, I don't know. He was, like, great. He said he was the greatest. And he was, you know, people were talking about him. He was going to be the heavyweight champion and all these, you know, things. And I thought, oh, this is like a, I don't know, listen, this is all right. Might be all right. This whole brown thing might not be so bad, you know. So I heard my mother say, he has a big mouth, that guy. And I'm like, well, what do you mean? And she's like, well, I don't like him. You know, I just was kind of like, well, I don't, this is like a bad deal. I felt very badly. Like, I didn't want to be, you know, brown. I just didn't.
The black man has been brainwashed, and it's time for him to learn something about himself. When he look at television, he see white owl cigars, white swan soap, king white soap.
I remember having heard someone say one time that he had said something about Mary Had a Little Lamb or something like that.
And he was a little boy that Mary Had a Little Lamb, his feet as white as snow.
But he says it in the context of, like, talking about the brainwashing that goes on. And I just thought that was funny that one of the things he talks about is Mary had a little lamb, and that, I mean, that's the town I was from.
Even though we grew up in the same place, we had really different childhoods. I'd lived in the town one town over from Adriana's town, and then I moved into her town when I was a freshman in high school.
I actually didn't know at first that she did live in Sterling because I had never seen her before. So, and she's like, oh, you just moved to Sterling. So I was like, oh, okay.
And I immediately liked her. We had French class together, and we kind of propped each other up through what was a really difficult year.
So I liked Jill. I just thought, this is, like, she's neat. I like her. And also, you know, she seemed to really like me.
When we were graduating from college, we were both 22, her father died. And at his funeral, her biological mother showed up.
You know, she's white, and she had two small children who were, you know, my color. And I was with a college friend of mine, Ed, and it was a very weird thing where I looked and I said, oh, Ed, I know who that is. He said, who is that? I said, oh, it's not good. It's not a good thing. And he said, what, who is it? I said, Ed, I think that's my birth mother. And he said, what?
That's Adriana Alti with Jill Lepore. Their story continues in a moment. You're listening to the New Yorker Radio Hour.
Hi, I'm Roz Chast from The New Yorker. The New Yorker Radio Hour is supported by NetSuite. Okay, quick math. The less your business spends on operations, on delivering your product or service, the more money you keep. Obvious. But with higher expenses on materials, employees, distribution, and borrowing, everything costs more. So to reduce costs and headaches, smart businesses are graduating to NetSuite by Oracle. NetSuite is the number one cloud financial system, bringing accounting, financial management, inventory, and HR into one platform. With NetSuite, you reduce IT costs because NetSuite lives in the cloud with no hardware required. You cut the cost of maintaining multiple systems because you've got one unified platform. Backed by popular demand, NetSuite has extended its one-of-a-kind flexible financing program for a few more weeks. Head to netsuite.com/New Yorker. netsuite.com/New Yorker.
The New Yorker Radio Hour is supported by the Sympathizer podcast from HBO. From executive producers Park Chan-wook and Robert Downey Jr., The Sympathizer is the new HBO original limited series based on the Pulitzer Prize-winning novel of the same name. On the Sympathizer podcast, join host Philip Nguyen in conversation with the cast, crew, and author Viet Thanh Nguyen as they discuss the making of this historic series. Stream new episodes of HBO's The Sympathizer, Sundays exclusively on Max, and listen to the Sympathizer podcast wherever you listen to podcasts.
I'm David Remnick, and welcome back to the New Yorker Radio Hour. Before the break, we heard Adriana Alti talk about growing up as a black girl in a white family in a mostly white town in New England. When she was a young woman, her biological mother came to talk to her at her father's funeral.
And I was thinking, oh my God, like, what is she doing here? Like, this is not a good thing. What's happening? And she said, hello. And I said, hello. And she said, you know, I'm your mother or whatever. And I said, okay. I was like, I know who you are.
That's Adriana. And here's New Yorker staff writer Jill Lepore, her old friend, with the story of how they started searching for Adriana's father.
I was mainly appalled at this woman for showing up at Adriana's father's funeral. But her story behind that was that she had tried to go to the house over the years to see Adriana, maybe even to steal her or to talk to her or something. But Adriana's father told her not to come back, to just respect the family.
So she saw in the paper that he was dead. So I guess she figured, well, he's dead. I don't know. There's a good and a bad sort of interpretation of it. On the one hand, she wanted to, like, pay respects. But also you could say, well, oh, so he's dead now. So now you don't have to respect his wishes anymore. You don't have now. He's, well, now it's fine. Very first day that I met her at the wake, and she asked me to come back to her house, she also asked me to come work for her. And she was actually published these magazines, and she probably thought it would be a good way for us to, you know, get to know each other. It just seemed like it was, she had this plan, and it just sounded like, and it sounded good, even though I was a little, you know, I was a little leery. But I'm like, well, how can I not do this? I mean, it works. You know, and I did end up working for her for a time. So when we were working, like, during the day or at the office, we were doing the thing of, like, trying to get to know each other a little bit. She used to say to me a lot, you think you know everything. You don't. And which I don't think I know everything, and I didn't think I knew everything then. But I said, why do you – she says, but I know you. She says, like, I know you because I knew your father.
The story that Adriana's birth mother told –
we'll call her Nina, but that is not her real name.
The story that Nina told is a really surprising one.
One of the first things Nina told me was that Bob Dylan really loved your father. And what you should do is, and it so happened that there, I guess the reason she thought to say this is that there was going to be a concert somewhere or something. And she said, you need to go and you need to, like, go backstage and, you know, introduce yourself to Bob Dylan and say you're Brown's daughter, and he will love you. He may even know something about where Brown is, you know. And so, of course, I'm listening to this, and I'm thinking, well, no. I mean, I'm not – this is not the sort of thing that I would do even if I believe it to be true. And at that point, I wasn't sure that I did.
If you're traveling in the North Country Fire, where the winds hit heavy on the borderline, remember me to one who lives there. For she once was a true love of mine.
Nina, in 1965, had gone to New York from Worcester. She was a Jewish woman from a very traditional, ordinary family in Worcester, kind of conventional. But she wanted to see the world like you would want to see the world in 1965. And the place you'd go is Greenwich Village, which in 1965 is just an incredibly interesting scene to be dropped in the middle of. It's an interesting scene poetically and musically and artistically. And when she was there, she fell in love with this street poet, a guy named William Brown.
She said, well, he would walk through Washington Square Park, and she saw him one day, and she just decided, you know, that she was going to have him. She just thought he was great.
What the hell is going on here?
See, we have a sort of a situation here. I fell in love with your daughter, and as incredible as it may seem, she fell in love with me. And we flew back to San Francisco to see if you or Mrs. Strayton would have any objections if we got married.
I guess they had their own version of guess who's coming to dinner, guess who's not staying for dinner kind of thing.
So Nina brought Brown from Greenwich Village. They went up to Worcester to meet Nina's parents. But it didn't go well. Not everyone is Spencer Tracy and Katharine Hepburn. And Nina's parents got really terribly upset. And it sounds like maybe even got a bit violent.
Particularly her father. But she said, he said to me, your father is in a lot of pain, so I'm going to leave. You need to stay here. You need to stay and be here with him, but I need to go. You know, of course, the one interpretation is, well, he ditched her. But that isn't the way she was saying it, and I think the point she was trying to make was that this man, like, you know, basically attacked him and was, you know, angry and got violent with him. And his response was, you know what, he's in pain and he's having a hard time. So I'm going to, you know, go.
That's the last time that Nina ever saw Brown. She found out she was pregnant and her parents decided she couldn't keep the baby and convinced her that she should give the baby up for adoption. They spirited her away to a lying-in hospital in Boston. And this would have been May of 1966. Nina gave birth, and when it came down to that moment, she couldn't give the baby up. She just couldn't do it. She was also really ill at the time, and so Adriana was put into foster care. It was an unusual placement. Actually, before about that time, in the middle of the 1960s, that kind of placement, interracial placement, putting a mixed race or a black child in a white family, that would have been incredibly unusual.
My name is Sheila Frankel. I work for the Department of Children and Families, Commonwealth of Massachusetts, and my job title is Adoption Search Coordinator.
Sheila Frankel worked for the state in the early 1970s, and the social worker who trained her is the social worker that went to that lying-in hospital in May of 1966 when Adriana was born and brought her to her foster family.
In the 60s, there was a lot of shame connected with adoption for all members of the adoption triad.
By the adoption triad, Sheila means the birth mother, the adoptee, and the adoptive parents.
Social workers try to match the physical characteristics of the child with the adoptive parents, and also the race and the ethnicity. But Clayton Hagen was the head of adoption for Lutheran Social Services, and more than transracial adoption, he had an idea that adoptive parents could figure out what they wanted and what they needed, what they could do. And if they wanted to adopt a child from another country or race, we should let them do it. We shouldn't ask too many questions. I don't think there was a lot of preparation for what went on. We actually, our agency placed many black and mixed racial children because of his influence. But I think it was 1972, the National Association of Black Social Workers protested this practice and they came out with a position paper.
And so after that, there was a whole new concern about whether this was the right thing to do to place these black and mixed race kids in white families. I mean, think about this moment, like the Black Panther movement has come to power. Muhammad Ali is talking about black is beautiful. There's a kind of notion of racial pride that's suffusing the whole culture. And then you have the adoptee rights movement with people looking back at their childhoods and saying maybe this wasn't the right thing. So after 1972, it's just a different conversation. I'm just really struck as a historian when I think about that time, that, you know, before 1966 when Adriana was born, or after 72 when she was finally adopted, there's just this moment, this little window in the middle of the 20th century where what happened to her could have happened. In May of 2015, Adriana was visiting. She visits a lot. She's really close to my kids. And I was in the middle of working on a New Yorker piece that I'd been really obsessed with all spring, where I was trying to track down this long-lost, forgotten African-American artist from the Harlem arts movement who happened to have been a sculptor. And Adriana is an artist and an amazing artist. And so I had 1,000 questions for her about sculpting. Like, how do you cast in bronze? And what does it mean to work in plaster? And she was really patient with all my questions. And finally, she just told me to stop.
I said, well, you need to, you know, can't you help me? You need to help me find my father. And I said it like that because, you know, she finds things. She gets things done. And I also knew that this sounded like something she should be very interested in.
So I was really interested. We, you know, I tried before and I hadn't had any luck. But the thing is that so much has changed. There's so much is on the internet that wasn't on the internet. Even to like month by month, week by week, new stuff is up there. There's like digital newspaper collections that weren't there. Recordings. So I said, all right, so I'm okay. I'll try. I will take a look.
Well, I will if.
Yeah, but if you gather up everything that you've done.
Put together a memo.
But she sent me this lovely, tidy email with all the research she'd done over the years and every little scrap of information that she found out about this guy, William Brown. And a lot of it is stuff that we've heard before, like, this is going to go nowhere. But then it was, at the bottom of the email, there was a list of things that he was called. And it was like, around town with William Brown. Or like, there were just like a bunch of rhyming things, downtown Brown. And one of them was Big Brown. So this seems like a made-up character.
And that actually is another reason that it probably sort of failed to find him sooner, is that there were other names. And also, I was always just looking for, you know, William Brown is a pretty common name. I thought that she meant like that was something that she called him, or that people, friends of his, called him. I think once we did have the internet, I was like, it never occurred to me to like look for Big Brown. I mean, it's like, well, people probably call him that, but that's not his real name.
Then when I started trying Big Brown and just like doing a basic Google search for like Big Brown and Bob Dylan, he pops up. And then he's kind of everywhere. The first thing that was incredible was finding this photograph that was from 1965 in Washington Square Park. It's quite a dramatic and beautiful photograph. He's a very large man, very strongly built, and speaking publicly before an audience. So you can see like a white college student sort of sitting at his feet, and another student with a backpack is wandering behind him. And he has his right arm outstretched and reaching upward and his index finger pointing. And if you follow the sort of sight line of his arm with the finger, it sort of goes up towards the American flag, which is waving from the top of a building in the background. I sent it to Adriana, and she didn't get right back. I emailed it to her, and she didn't get right back. So I texted it to her, and I said, oh, my God, this is your father. Oh, my God, this is your father.
And I said, well, why do you say that? You know, why? Because he's big and he's brown? And I was kind of joking, kind of not. She's like, no, that's not why, because I think it, you know, I think it looks good. She's like, I'm 100% certain, and I don't know. Like, I'm, you know, so I started to think, well, if I do see it now, am I, like, trying to see something because I want it to be true? So I sent the picture to Nina. You know, she wrote back, oh, my God, where did you get that? That's him.
So after we found this incredible photograph, I looked up the photographer. It's this guy named Leroy Henderson.
This guy Brown, Big Brown, he would be out there reciting his poetry. And he was really quite vocal and quite, you know, big guy, huge guy. And so that picture of him, and with him looming in the foreground like that, with that expression on his face, and with his finger pointing in the air, he was good for those gestures.
So what do you think it says about Brown? He could have been up in Harlem doing his poetry, but he's gone down in the village and he's doing it to like a different audience.
I think that's a sign of his vision. I think that shows that this guy saw something beyond being a black man. If he had stayed up in Harlem or East New York, Brooklyn, something, that probably would have been too limiting. And furthermore, I think the issues of concern in the black community were too intense to be concerned about this creative expression. We were worried about how to survive, how to pay, you know. I mean, they were dealing with issues of social justice and racial equality and all. And Brown, I'm sure, was too. And also, he might have felt that he had a message coming from a black man's point of view that he felt that a white audience need to hear.
That's Leroy Henderson with staff writer Jill Lepore talking about the search for William Brown, known as Big Brown. In a minute, Jill and Adriana Alty find that some of the wildest rumors they heard about Big Brown turn out to be true, and they discover the sounds that he left behind.
Let each man kill the thing he loves.
I'm David Remnick. That's ahead on the New Yorker Radio Hour.
By all, let this be heard. Some do it with a bitter look. Some with a flattering word. The coward does it with a kiss, the brave man with a sword. Some people love when they're young, and some when they're old.
Hi, I'm Roz Chast from The New Yorker. The New Yorker Radio Hour is supported by NetSuite. Okay, quick math. The less your business spends on operations, on delivering your product or service, the more money you keep. Obvious. But with higher expenses on materials, employees, distribution, and borrowing, everything costs more. So to reduce costs and headaches, smart businesses are graduating to NetSuite by Oracle. NetSuite is the number one cloud financial system, bringing accounting, financial management, inventory, and HR into one platform. With NetSuite, you reduce IT costs because NetSuite lives in the cloud with no hardware required. You cut the cost of maintaining multiple systems because you've got one unified platform. Backed by popular demand, NetSuite has extended its one-of-a-kind flexible financing program for a few more weeks. Head to netsuite.com/New Yorker. netsuite.com/New Yorker.
I'm David Remnick. Thanks for joining us today on the New Yorker Radio Hour. Next week, we'll hear from Aziz Ansari about pitching ethnically diverse TV shows.
They say things like, well, I don't know if mainstream audiences will enjoy that. And what that basically means is, I'm not sure white people are going to relate to that. Guess what? White people relate to anything. People watch anime movies about bugs and fish. They're relating to those problems.
That's next time on the New Yorker Radio Hour. Today is a special episode of the show that we're devoting to one story, Adriana Alti's quest, aided by her friend Jill Lepore, to find her biological father. His name was William Brown, but they didn't know his date of birth or where he was born. And he left a record of himself only through his poetry, performing as Big Brown.
You put Big Brown in YouTube, and, you know, his album comes up.
And Adriana starts emailing me, oh my God, I found a recording.
Here he is, the poet, with his album Between Heaven and Hell, Big Brown.
There are all these songs, and there suddenly we have his voice. And suddenly I can hear him, you know, this is him talking.
The blues rhyme there, blowing away any char of gladness until you find that you're like a sunken man in this ocean of sorrows and sadness.
It's a bit of a mystery when it was recorded, but it's 7 tracks, and it's Big Brown. It's called Big Brown, the first man of poetry. Like, there's one that's called Me, and it starts off, the greatest cat I ever met is me.
The greatest cat I ever met is me. There's been no cat I could love or pet.
It's very, very funny poem. It's so winking and parodic, and it's just funny.
Look at me. I'm a sly, witty guy, but I maintain my high and don't love nobody but everybody.
So we had this, you know, very exciting moment where we had found this recording, and then, but of course, then there was a you know, a brief lull. So, because we went to dinner and we weren't talking about it, because we'd been talking, and we weren't talking about it. And I said, "Oh no, she's gonna move on." So I said, "What about this Danny Fitzgerald character? What would you look into that?"
So Danny Fitzgerald is a blues musician, and he lived in New York in the 1960s. And Adrian had found an album that he recorded. Talk about that time.
I met Big Brown in Washington Square Park. Yeah, he was a poet. That, what's his name, got a lot of his up from him. Bob Dylan.
Right. So I said to Jill, well, why don't you just call Dylan?
so I got an email address for the guy who handles Dylan's email, and I wrote to him, and we thought he would talk to us, but in the end he didn't talk to us. But Adriana found something else.
Yes, I did. It turns out that he has given interviews where he talks about Brown. He said, all these black guys would come up from south of the border and recite poetry in the park. Now they call them rappers. The best was a guy named Big Brown who had long poems. Each one was about 50 minutes long. They were long, drawn-out bad men stories. Romance, politics, just about everything you can imagine was thrown into his stuff. I always thought this was the best poetry I ever heard. Now, you have Bob Dylan saying this is the best poetry you ever heard.
Yeah, that's now, not nothing.
That's not nothing, and that's, Nina actually was, what she was saying was true.
If Big Brown had been performing in Harlem, it would have been just like another guy, and people would have been like, yeah, he happens to be very good at doing it. But it stood out, in a different way, I think, in Greenwich Village than it would have in a different neighborhood. In fact, it stood out so much to people who were interested in the 1960s in the study of folklore and folk life that a bunch of folklore scholars began collecting these things that are called toasts, which are these they're like braggart poems. They're these rhyming poems about – there are a lot of them are about hustlers. They tend to be sexually outrageous. There's a lot about pimps and prostitutes, and they have this whole badass thing going on.
Honky-tonk Bud, the hip cat, stood, was digging a game of poop. His pants wasn't sagging, but this cat wasn't bragging because he knew he was looking real cool. He was choked up tight.
My name is Abiodun Oyewole, and I'm a poet educator.
Abiodun Oyewole was a founder of The Last Poets in 1968.
Selfish desires are burning like fires among those who hoard the gold.
So many of us who were researching the whole oral tradition situation in America, we had to go back to the toast. Just like those folks in the toast had to know something about High John the Conqueror and People Who Could Fly, which are folk tales that we brought with us from the slave plantations. And so that was really just a part of your learning process if you wanted to get down with what they call the spoken word.
And those who stole the people's gold are definitely corrupt. Credit cards, master charge, legacies of wills, real estate.
You know, I know the toasts were born basically in prison. A lot of guys would just sit around and be creative. You know, it's like they say, necessity is the mother of invention. So you don't have a TV, you don't have your boys on the block, you don't have all the things to do that you would have to do if you were not incarcerated. So you're sitting around, and your mind is still working, but how do you direct it? So guys would create stories. They would create these phenomenal stories of all these colorful characters. Of course, Durella DuFontaine was one. She could persuade you to do things that you didn't want to do and give her money that you didn't want to give, but she always came out on top.
I was standing on the corner in the middle of the square, trying to make me some arrangements.
Durella DuFontaine is a toast. It's a toast that Brown was known to have performed in Washington Square Park. And in 1969, The Last Poets recorded a version of it with Jimi Hendrix.
It's that hand in the glove when you look at it. I mean, with Big Brown and Ginsberg and all the beat poets were doing down the village, it's alive and well today in more ways than one. I mean, these guys represent something that we are trying to capture now. We've got a whole generation of young people who are living, breathing, and dying with the word.
David Amram is a well-known composer and conductor and jazz musician. And in the 1960s, he was living in the village and knew a lot of the same people that Big Brown knew. He hung out with Ginsberg and Kerouac. And he tells a story about a time he brought a classical composer who was visiting from Europe down to Washington Square Park to meet Brown.
I said, Brown, this is a guy from Tondaleo. He's from Holland, and he's a wonderful composer. He came all the way over here. Symphony played his piece, and he wants to check out all of America. And Brown said, come on with me, man. So we walked over, and he gestured. So he took us to the middle of the fountain. He said, here's where you're going to see and hear it all. And Big Brown says, see what I told you, man? And then he started one of his raps into Tom's ear, and Tom put his hand up to hear Brown, and then with his other hand, had on his other ear, was listening to all those great sounds at the same time. Brown had become like a sports announcer describing all the different things that was happening, and then also giving a little rundown of the people who were playing, you know, saying that cat's from Ohio and he ran away from home and he's a songwriter and this accordion player's family's lived in the village like for two generations and doesn't speak English and went through the whole routine. And Tom said, now, he said, I've seen and heard America.
Let me say first that I accept the nomination of the Democratic Party.
One thing I found, which was very, actually very strange, and it took a while to figure out what it was Big Brown was nominated for as a presidential candidate as part of the Beat Party of America.
So I looked up in the newspaper, and it turns out there was an AP wire service story in the summer of 1960 when Nixon and Kennedy are the nominees for the major parties. There's a third party ticket. The Beat Party of America holds a mock presidential primary contest in Greenwich Village. And during the first round of voting, Big Brown got the most votes. So the AP wire service story reads like this. Big Brown's lead startled the convention. Big, as the husky Negro is called by his friends, wasn't the favorite sonny of any delegation, but he had one tactic that apparently earned him votes. In a chatterbox convention, only once did he speak at length, and that was to read his poetry.
No, I don't indulge in politics, but I spoke at the UN Nation on foreign situations and possible integration. Didn't nobody speak but me. I'm with the whole South Sea.
Nina had always said she didn't know whatever happened to Big Brown, but she had heard years later that he was run over by a steamroller in Hollywood and killed. And I thought, I put that in the category of crazy-ass things that Nina says that no one could possibly believe, because that is out of Looney Tunes. Like, that is not a real death. That is what happens after Wile E. Coyote drops an anvil on your head. Then Danny Fitzgerald says on this recording we're listening to on the way home, says...
And then he went to California, and he got run over.
I mean, maybe he really did get run over by a steamroller. It was really hard to find out. Adrian tracked down all kinds of people that might have known Brown. Danny knew this guy named Bill Gross. Brown once stayed in Gross's apartment, found this guy named Ned Otter. His father had taken pictures of Brown when Ned was a kid. There were pictures of Brown on the wall of his apartment. And so we asked all these people, like, what happened to him? Did he really get run over by a steamroller?
I heard that he had been in California and been on a beach. I don't know why the name Manhattan Beach comes to my mind. I believe the version I heard was that he was got in a fight, or that he was attacked at night on this beach and stabbed. And this is what comes to mind. I know Danny says he was run over, but I believe it was some kind of a violent death.
I heard he was rubbed out by mobsters. I heard he was shot during a card game, like a poker game. Shot or maybe run over.
Did you ever hear run over by a steamroller?
No.
Okay, because that's the one we keep hearing. So did you ever hear stabbed on a beach?
Nope.
Did you say, my friend, that you're not afraid on this day when you meet death? Will you tell me that when the day arrives and you take your very last breath? Now, you've got to die. You know that's true, but you say it bothers you none. Oh, I see.
Everyone who said anything about him, or anything I've read about him, is that he is not only is a character, but he's the kind of person that you know, if he's around, it's not like he's going to go unnoticed. In that sense, either he's gone, or he's in some way so diminished from what he was that, you know, is not recognizable as the same person. So either way, this person can't be around, because how could someone like that be around and not have anyone take note?
So once we kind of really were hunkered down looking for Big Brown, I thought, oh, I should see if there's any – he's this poet. You know, there's all these collections of poetry and sound archives all over the place. So I went to, like, the obvious places, like the Woodbury Poetry Room at Harvard, and looked through their archive and just various – then I went through oral history collections trying to see if anybody – I thought, this oral history movement in the 1960s, someone surely sat this guy down and did an oral history. I came up with nothing. So then I was looking through the finding guides to the collections at New York University, which is in Washington Square. Was pouring through the Larry Rivers collection. Rivers was this kind of beat artist of some renown and acclaim, and he was also a filmmaker. He's a painter and filmmaker.
Rivers, actually, I had known him mostly as like a painter, so I actually didn't know about this film that he had made. He made a film, a documentary of sorts about breasts, and I was like, oh, okay, here we go. You know, this is the perfect setup for what we're going to hear is probably not going to make me very happy.
Yeah, we didn't know that it was...
Yeah, we didn't know.
We just saw it was Brown on tape. We had no idea it was about breasts.
Like, for instance, if you're with a woman, isn't it mainly that you make the aggressive suckling gestures and that she very rarely... I mean, I have...
Women are looking for you continuously as hard as you're looking for them. If they like you,
or if they're curious about you, they are seeking you as strongly as you're looking for them, you know?
You know, Larry's trying to sort of lead him down this, like, well, how do you feel about breasts? Are they... And Brown goes off in this whole sort of, well, you know, they're part of the woman, and you're going to know the woman in there. So I'm thinking, oh, good, good, he's good, he's a good, good man. I was proud. I just felt like, oh, he was led down this path that could have been really very unpleasant to hear, and he just was great.
They're talking just like you talk out of your mouth.
But breasts or?
Absolutely.
Well, what about elbows? What's wrong with elbows?
I never went out that far.
Well, that's what I'm trying to say.
But then I'm sitting there thinking, like, Rivers, just ask him, like, where were you born? What year were you born?
Right,
what's
right.
your social security number? Well, what's your actual name?
I mean, here's
name?
Someone who's actually talking to him. Where are the important questions?
Like, nothing.
It's like, this is
that I want to know.
Exactly.
You know, I mean, unless a cat can play her, you know, for the sound and the rhythm and the jazz that come from her, you know what I mean? She's just, you know, just a nice girl.
I was thinking about it after lunch, and I said, what are you going to do now? And you're like, I'm going to go back. And I was like, why? Well, like, we already listened to it, and we transcribed it mostly. And you're like, oh, I just want to listen to him.
Yeah. It's probably simplistic to say, but, I mean, they make him like a real person, where I've known of him, about him, since, you know, I met my birth mother, so for, you know, almost 30 years. And I didn't ever really sort of get from her the feeling of, like, that I knew him. So it kind of has done that. And it's interesting what, you know, what Lemur was saying about being in the village. And, you know, he's an artist, so he was there. And, you know, Brown was performing, he's an artist, and he was there. But there weren't really black people, that many black people. There was predominantly a white thing, but people were there because of their art and because of their, you know, what they were trying to do. And that's something that I've had, a struggle with, and that, you know, I went from being very young to going to art school where I was, you know, maybe one of two black people in the whole, practically in the whole, you know, school, or at least my class. And, you know, not just an artist, not a black artist, not a white artist, but you're just an artist.
Most of us go through life finding people and losing people and finding them again. And that's actually a big part of why I'm a historian. I like to figure out where things came from, but I also like to find things that have gotten lost and find people that have gotten lost. So this story has actually been really hard for me because I thought we would find him, like find him, meet him, find out exactly what happened to him. And it's really hard to find a guy named William Brown. But I know, too, that it's meant so much to Adriana to find out what we have found. And I kind of think that she's kind of put the pieces of him back together in a way that brings him to life. She was visiting when we were kind of finishing up doing the research that we had done. And she said, I have to go home now because I've just ordered 50 pounds of brown clay. It's going to be delivered. And I have to get home because I have to be there to pick it up. And I said, okay, well, hold on. Wait, like back up. What are you going to do with 50 pounds of clay?
I decided to make some sculptures of him.
So what does that mean?
That means
to make him.
To make him, well, you know, I mean, it means, literally means, you know, putting the clay on the armature and making his face. Like, now that I know what he looks like and can sort of guess. You know, I have a lot of ideas for different things that I want to do based on, you know, him. I don't know. It has actually been a while that I've been very, you know, excited to make something, and I don't know.
So do you feel like you found him?
I do feel like I found enough to feel like I knew who he was, and it makes me very happy in a way that, you know, when I was younger, I didn't want anything to do, you know, with that at all. And by the time I had, you know, sort of gotten old enough to realize that, you know, it's not bad to be brown or whatever. I hadn't lived as part of a black community, a community of color, and so I felt a little like I'm almost like an imposter in some ways. Like I felt that I was, you know, appropriating something, and because I didn't feel connected myself to it. And maybe that is what I'm doing, but I know that I feel more connected to it, and I feel like I'm in a way have a right to, you know, this person who's like, turns out is like a pretty great guy. you know, and I'm very happy about that. I'm happier than I would have thought that I would be. That I definitely didn't anticipate that I would feel like connected to him in a way, because, you know, I met my birth mother, and, you know, she is my birth mother, but I couldn't see myself in her. And I don't know him, but everything I have heard about him makes me feel like I know him, and I feel like I am like him. I mean, I'm actually like somebody where, I mean, I've never been like anyone that I've ever known. So, you know, and still felt like that I could claim them in a way.
You are like him. I mean, I think for me to see that photograph and see how much he looks like you, and the first time you sent me the record, listening to that first track, I remember just, oh my God, how can that be inheritable? Like, you sound like him to me. So it fills in a lot for me. So I feel, in this very different way, I'm so happy to have found the best poet Bob Dylan ever knew.
When you get all you long for in your struggles in life, then the world make you king for a day. Go to the mirror and look at yourself and see what that guy has to say. For it is not your mother, your sister, or your brother whose judgment upon you must pass. The guy who counts most in your life is the guy staring back from the glass. He's the one to live up to, never mind all the rest, for he's with you, clear up to the end. And you'll pass your most dangerous, difficult task if the guy in the glass is your friend. You could be like Jack Hall and chisel a plum, thinking you're a wonderful guy. But the guy in the glass say you're only a bum if you can't look him square in the eye. You could fool the whole world down the pathway of years and get pats on your back as you pass. But your final reward would be heartaches and tears if you cheated the guy in the glass. To thine own self, be true.
That's The New Yorker's Jill Lepore with her friend, the artist Adriana Alti. Our story, The Search for Big Brown, aired in the first episodes of The New Yorker Radio Hour, and since that time, we've heard from some listeners with leads about Brown's time in California and his fate. I'm David Remnick, and thanks for joining us. Let us know what you thought of today's show and leave a comment on newyorkerradio.org. Next week, we'll be back with more stories, and I'll speak with a reporter for the New York Times who's been covering ISIS from the very beginning.
They literally believe that they are living at the moment before the rapture, to use the Christian corollary. They think they're on the verge of this end-of-times battle. And it's not just some sort of metaphor. They really believe that this is going to happen and that they are there. You know, a lot of them have profile pictures of them on horses. They think they're going to be there on, you know, on their black steed at the moment of, you know, of the end of the world.
Rukmini Kalamaki is a foreign correspondent for The New York Times. That's next time on The New Yorker Radio Hour. See you next week.
The New Yorker Radio Hour is a co-production of WNYC Studios and The New Yorker. Our theme music was composed and performed by Meryl Garbus of Tune Yards. This episode was produced by Emily Botine, Ave Carrillo, Rhiannon Corby, Jill Duboff, Karen Frillman, David Krasnow, Sarah Nix, Paul Schneider, and Stephen Valentino, with help from Eric Malinsky and Becky Cooper.
WNYC Studios is supported by W.W. Norton & Company, publishers of The Road to Freedom, Economics and the Good Society, by Nobel Prize-winning economist Joseph E. Stiglitz. The Road to Freedom, essential reading for those committed to the American ideal of an economic and political system that delivers well-being, opportunity, and meaningful freedoms for all. The Road to Freedom, available now wherever books are sold.